In our episode today, we have a very personal and moving conversation prepared for you with a special guest. Captain Paul Watson is the co-founder of Greenpeace, he's the founder of Sea Shepherd, and he's a very inspiring human being, and as a result, there's also been numerous movies produced about his life. Maybe you've even seen one of them. He's personally, in my opinion, a role model when it comes to fighting for that which he believes is the right thing to do in this world. He's often portrayed as the most fearless activist in the world, and his life's mission is to protect and to conserve endangered species and the diversity of life in our oceans. And in our episode, Paul and I are discussing three virtues needed to change the world in his perception. He's talking about life-changing experiences that he's had in over 40 years of adventures out in the sea. He's covering the three basic laws of ecology, and he's also talking about our relationship with the ocean. And one thing that has fascinated me a lot about our conversation is when Paul shares a couple of very inspiring stories that are proof that it's always passionate individuals with a cause that is greater than themselves that create the biggest impacts in our world.
Hi, ich bin Jonathan Sierk und willkommen bei den Gesprächen von morgen.
Paul, welcome to our show. It's a great honor to have you here. I'm really, really looking forward to our conversation.
Well, thank you.
I must say that I really admire and respect you for the work that you do, and that I've watched your video about, or your YouTube video in your own words, about a dozen times. And every time I watch it, I get goosebumps, and it really moves me. I just find that it's great for people like me to see that there are people like you out there who fight for what they believe is the right thing. And in one of your videos, you were mentioning that there are three virtues needed to change the world, and it's passion, courage, and imagination. And before we talk about how and if you can develop those virtues in others and if they can be learned, I would like to know and understand from you where your passion and your courage comes from.
That's really hard to answer. I was raised in a wilderness area on the east coast of Canada, very close to nature. When I was 10 years old, I had an experience, I think a life-changing experience, where I had spent the summer swimming with a family of beavers in the forest. And the next summer when I went back to look for the beavers, they weren't there. Found out trappers had killed them all during the winter. So that made me very angry. And that winter, I began to walk trap lines and free the animals and destroy the traps. So that's started my life as an activist at 11. And then in 1969, when I was 18, I was the youngest founding member of the Greenpeace Foundation. And in 1977, I left to set up Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. I really can't abide, the destruction of life and the destruction of ecosystems. And that, I guess, I'm quite passionate about that.
You share in one of your videos that in 1975 you were in a Zodiac inflatable and you've placed yourself between whales and harpoons, and that really changed your life. Could you share that experience and talk about like what exactly happened and how that has impacted everything you've done ever since?
Well, in 1975, I was a member of the Greenpeace 5 crew, and that was the first campaign to protect whales. And we were searching for the Soviet whaling fleet, which we found about 60 miles off the coast of California. This is before the 200-mile limit. And we were reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, so I thought that the thing to do was to, we were going to block them, get our bodies between the harpoons and the whales. And that's what we did. So Robert Hunter and I found ourselves in a small inflatable boat in front of a Soviet harpoon vessel that was barreling down on us at full speed. And in front of us were eight incredible sperm whales that were fleeing for their life. And every time the harpooner tried to get a shot, I would block the shot with the boat. And this worked for about 20 minutes until the captain on the Soviet harpoon vessel came running down the catwalk and screamed into the ear of the harpooner, then turned, looked down on us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I realized that Gandhi wasn't going to work for us that day. And a few moments later, there was this horrendous explosion, and the harpoon flew over our heads and slammed into the backside of one of the whales in the pod. And it was a female, and she screamed and she rolled on her side. There was blood everywhere. And suddenly the largest whale in that pod hit the water with his tail. It was like a thunderclap was striking the water. And he dove straight down and he swam underneath of us and threw himself at the harpooner on the bow of the Soviet whaling vessel. And they were there waiting for him. And they had put in another harpoon, an unattached harpoon, and at point blank range, the harpooner shot that whale straight in the head, and the whale fell back and screaming, rolling, water everywhere, blood everywhere. And as he was rolling about in agony on the surface, I caught his eye, and he disappeared again. And now I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming at us real fast. And he came up and out of the water at an angle so that the next move would be to come straight down on top of us and crush us. And as his head rose out of the water and I looked into this eye, an eye the size of my fist, what I saw there was understanding. That I felt that the whale understood what we were trying to do, because I could see the effort he made to pull himself back, and his head began to slide back into the sea. His eye disappeared beneath the surface and he died. So it could have killed us and made that decision not to. So personally, I owe my life to that particular whale. He had every right to attack us, and he made that he discriminated and did not carry through. And as we sat there in this small boat and in the middle of the Soviet whaling fleet, the sun was going down, and I said to myself, why are they killing these whales? You can't eat sperm whale meat. They kill them for oil. It's a high heat resistant lubricating oil, especially spermaceti oil from the head of the whale. And that was highly prized, especially in the Soviet Union, for lubricating intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said to myself, here we are, destroying these incredibly beautiful, socially complex, magnificent animals, self-aware, sentient beings, for the sole purpose of making a weapon meant for the extermination, the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it struck me, we are insane, totally insane, especially ecologically insane. And I said from that moment on, I'll be doing what I'm doing for them, not for us, but for the sentient beings that live in the ocean. Those are our clients, and that's who we represent, and that's what we fight for.
And that was in 1975, and you just mentioned that in 1977 you founded Sea Shepherds, right? Like, was that the decisive moment for you to say that you will leave Greenpeace to find your own mission, or like what happened after that?
No, I led two campaigns to protect seals on the East Coast in 76 and 77. But Greenpeace was becoming more and more bureaucratic, and I couldn't do what I wanted to do. And also, I was very frustrated with this Quaker point of view, which is you bear witness. And to me, that's a form of cowardice. You know, you don't walk down the street and see a woman being raped or a kitten being stomped to death and do nothing but take pictures and hang banners. And that's what we were doing. And I said, no, I'm going to set something up that's going to be not protesting, but intervening, an interventionist organization. Protesting to me is very submissive. It's like, please, please, please don't kill the whales. And they do it anyway. And you can't do anything about it, but take their picture. So setting up Sea Shepherd as an interventionist group, I think we've had much more success. And I also adapted a couple of things. One was a strategy, which I call aggressive nonviolence. And we're quite proud of our record on that. In 42 years, we've never caused a single injury. We haven't killed anybody. And but we've shut down hundreds and hundreds of illegal operations. We're aggressive, but at the same time, nonviolent. And that's what we continue to do to this day.
Could you take us, the listeners, and me on one of those missions? Like, how do you prepare for it? What does it look like? And you're the captain of Sea Shepherd now, I think, since 2 or 3 years again, and you weren't for a few years. But when you prepare for one, like what does it look like? How long are you out on the ocean? And maybe you can just explain what it looks like.
Well, today, of course, Sea Shepherd is run by numerous directors, captains, officers, and everything. It's become an international movement, which is great because that's what I've always wanted. When I was captain of a vessel, you know, you organize the campaign. One of the things I do when people want to join, and we still ask this today, is we ask them one simple question. Are you willing to risk your life to protect a whale? And if they say no, then we're not really interested in having them. And people say, well, that's asking a lot of young people to ask them to risk their life to protect a whale. I don't think so. In our societies, we ask young people all the time to risk their life and to kill people to protect real estate, oil wells, religion, patriotism, whatever. I think it's a far more noble endeavor to risk your life to protect an endangered species or a threatened habitat. So to me, that's a measure of dedication, is the willingness to take that risk. Also look for people who have courage, who have passion, who are resourceful. And then we put that together. We look for a combination of professionalism and passion. So you don't have to be a professional to join the crew. In fact, you can't buy that kind of passion, you know, that the volunteers give to us. We wouldn't be able to get what we need to do if we had to rely on hired people. And so that's always been the backbone of our movement, is this dependence upon our volunteer, an army of volunteers. So right now, I think we have about 25 different nationalities represented on the cruise, and that's about 250 volunteers in total on 11 ships.
And I want to comment the point that you made, that you can't buy that kind of passion, and because you say that frequently. Where do you think their passion comes from? And do you think you're born with it? Can you develop it? And then also the determination that you mentioned, is that innate, or?
I think that's an individual thing. People come by their passion for protecting diversity or life or an environment. They come by that, their own personal experience. Maybe something that they, an environment that they really loved was destroyed, or maybe a relative died of a disease caused by environmental issues, or maybe a particular animal or a plant that they love is being wiped out. It's hard to really say. It's really an individual thing. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't grill everybody who come and ask them why. But, you know, back in 1911, the London Times criticized Ernest Shackleton on his campaign to Antarctica, saying that his crew were all a bunch of amateurs, and why didn't he have professionals? And his answer is something that I certainly adhere to. He says, I don't want professionals. I need people with the passion to get me to where I need to go, and I can't do that with professionals. You pay them, but they just don't have that passion. And I have to admit that the same problems he had with the few professionals he had are the same problems I have. They're the biggest troublemakers on the boat. If I have to hire somebody and they're working for money, they're usually the people we have problems with.
How many people apply to become volunteers on your ship? Like you said, you have currently around 200, 250 people. Do you get a lot of applications?
I think we have a couple of thousand applications right now. I don't really monitor that.
Oh, wow.
Committee that goes through there. The problem in the early days, the problem was getting crew members. Now the problem is having just unfortunately reject so many people, and we're only rejecting them because we just simply don't have room. But we try to give everybody the opportunity to participate whenever that opportunity presents itself. But so it's frustrating in that thing. It's just completely opposite to where we were when we first began. Now we have a surplus of talent and surplus of abilities and certainly a surplus of passion, which is good, but it's disappointing to people who have to wait in order to participate. Mm.
So what would you say that if our listeners or anyone who would want to support your cause, like what could we do to help?
Well, people can certainly volunteer to work on the ships and put a crew application in. And a little hint here, if you really want to get on the ships, you just show up and do volunteer work on one of the ships when they're in port, and that usually gets you in the door. But also we have shore support groups, people who don't want to or can't go to sea, who help us to support the ships materially by getting donations, not just of money, but also of materials when we need it, and helping to promote what we're doing. And of course, people can support us just by being financial contributors. The unique thing about Sea Shepherd as compared to other organizations is that right from the beginning, I decided that we're not going to spend money on self-promotion. A lot of these organizations spend 75% of their income on going after more money. We don't do that. We want to say to people, if you donate 1 euro to Sea Shepherd, we can say that euro, where it's going to go. It's going to run those ships and everything. We're not going to put it into fundraising or advertising or getting people on the street with clipboards and canvassers. That's not going to happen. The bad part about that, or the down part of that, is that we're relatively small compared to the organization. I mean, Greenpeace today brings in about 350 million euros a year. We bring in 12. We have 11 ships. They have three. So we can run those 11 ships on a fraction of what they bring in, because the bulk of their money goes into raising more money.
How do you decide where your boats are going? Like, if you have 11 boats, do you like monitor where there's the biggest alarm or where there's the biggest need? Or we would probably need a lot more boats in order to protect all the endangered animals out there in the oceans. Like how do you prioritize?
We do need more vessels because there's so many more things to do. We have a global board of national directors, and we meet and we decide, you know, is there something where we can make a difference? That's the main criteria. Is there a problem that we can address and make a difference? And we started in 1999 with doing partnerships, when we partnered with the Galapagos National Park and the Ecuadorian Environmental Police to protect the Galapagos Marine Reserve. That has now evolved into a situation where we have partnerships with numerous African and Latin American countries. This is actually a unique situation. I don't know of any international non-government organizations that have this kind of partnership. What that means is that we provide the resources and the crew, and those countries provide the authority, the enforcement authority. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in African nations over the last year, we've arrested 52 poaching vessels. In Mexico, working in partnership with the Mexican Navy, we've confiscated over 1,200 illegal poaching nets. And we've actually ensured that no poaching takes place in the Vaquita Refuge. So I'm actually quite confident that if it wasn't for our involvement for the last 7 years, that the Vaquita porpoise would now be extinct. And so this approach has worked really quite well. And, you know, we're working now with Zambia and Namibia and Gabon, Sao Tome, Liberia, Benin, and also with Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and Mexico. And we've also worked with the authorities in Sicily. And this is making a significant difference. We're also working with Interpol and going after vessels which are operating illegally.
That's great. I think it's fantastic to hear that. One of the things that you mention as well is that in your perception, it's not governments or big companies that make the biggest differences in the world, but it's passionate individuals. And I would be curious to understand, like, how do you identify or spot that passion in individuals, and how do you become a passionate individual yourself?
Well, people come to us, really. We don't really go after anybody. Okay. I mean, we have an advisory board of celebrities and experts. They come to us. We didn't go and recruit them. Our crew come to us. We don't recruit them either. Same with membership. So we're demonstrating what we can do, and if people support it, then we welcome their participation and their support. But we really don't go out looking for people.
But like, what would you say if someone would be interested in identifying with you, especially as a person, and seeing the courage that you have, the passion that you have, striving to become a passionate individual themselves? What would you say does it take to become a passionate individual?
I'll give you a couple of examples. Back in 1982, I get a call from a man in Scotland, and he says, "They're killing gray seals here in the Orkney Islands. What are you going to do about it?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm on the other side of the planet. My question is, what are you going to do about it? You live in Scotland." And he said, "Well, what can I do?" So anyway, we helped him to set up Sea Shepherd Scotland. And he took a crew up to the Orkney Islands and were quite aggressive in what they're in there. They all got arrested for protecting seals. But the publicity that they raised helped us to raise enough money to buy that island. So that particular Orkney Island we now own. It's a seal sanctuary. So, and it all because one guy in Scotland said, you know, what can I do? Another example, 1979, I had an 18-year-old crew member, Alex Pacheco, And he said, we got to do something about the treatment of chimpanzees and monkeys in laboratories. And I said, Alex, this is Sea Shepherd. We're not going into any laboratories. But, well, somebody's got to do something, he says. And I said, well, why don't you do something, you know, if you're passionate about it? And he said, well, what can I do? I said, use your imagination. So he went back to Maryland in the U.S. and got a job in one of the laboratories. He documented everything in that laboratory for a year, turned all over the evidence to the authorities, to the media, and shut that laboratory down. And then he went on to found his own organization, which is now the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. So a lot of organizations and groups have been put together by former crew members. And I'm telling people, I say, you don't have to do what we do. You just have to follow what you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. Because of Diane Fossey, we have mountain gorillas in Rwanda. Because of David Wingate, the Bermuda storm petrel has survived. Because of Brute Geldikas, our orangutans were protected. One person can make a huge difference, you know. And I can't, yeah. You know, there's so many opportunities. And right now I'm seeing more than ever, so many people, especially young people, who are dedicating themselves to specific issues, this species, this ecosystem, or this issue. I mean, Greta Thunberg is a good example of how one person can really make a difference when you're addressing yes. things like climate change.
Yes.
And we're seeing more and more of that, which is good, because the only way, I mean, the strength of an ecosystem is in diversity and interdependence. Therefore, the strength of any movement has to be in diversity and interdependence. And that diversity means millions of people addressing millions of issues in their own way and being passionate about it, using their abilities and their skills to make a change. And I believe everybody is capable of changing things. And when people say, well, it's a little overwhelming, I said, well, don't worry about the odds. You know, don't worry about winning or losing. Just dedicate yourself to what you do best. And I said, yeah, but it's so impossible. And the answer to that is sometimes the answer or the solution to an impossible situation is to find the impossible solution. And that's possible. An example, in 1972, the very idea that Nelson Mandela would become president of South Africa was unthinkable and therefore impossible. And yet the impossible became possible. So I believe the impossible solution is just there waiting to be found.
I think that's a great mindset. And I can really relate to that. And you just mentioned biodiversity and you mentioned interdependence and you cover like three basic laws of ecology, which you say are crucial for our survival and the future on planet Earth. The third one is, apart from the law of biodiversity and the law of interdependence of our species, is the law of finite resources. Could you explain those three laws in a bit more detail?
Well, no species can live on this planet outside of the three basic laws of ecology. Diversity, ecosystem needs diversity to survive. Interdependence, that the species within that ecosystem need each other. They're interdependent with each other. If you remove one, then you cause disruptions throughout the entire ecosystem. The law of finite resources is that there's a limit to growth, a limit to carrying capacity. And when you steal the carrying capacity of other species that take more than you actually need, you're therefore causing diminishment both of in diversity and in interdependence, which leads to a crash. I guess the best way that I explain it, especially to younger people, is this. The Earth is a spaceship, and it's on this incredible voyage around the Milky Way galaxy, and every spaceship has to have a life support system, and that provides us with the air we breathe and the food we eat and regulates climate and temperature. And that life support system, the machinery for that, has to be run by a crew. And human beings are not crew members on Spaceship Earth. We're passengers. We're having a wonderful time entertaining ourselves. But we're the passengers. We're not running the machinery. But what we are doing is killing off the crew that do run the machinery. And there's only so many crew members you can kill before the machinery begins to fall apart. If we lose phytoplankton, we die. If we lose bees and worms, we die. If we lose trees, we die. We're dependent upon these other species for our very survival and existence. The problem is that about 10,000 years or so ago, we developed this attitude, which I call anthropocentrism, that we're all important. Everything was created just for us, and nothing else really matters. Everything else is to be used by us and abused by us. And before that, and in many indigenous societies today, the outlook is biocentric. We're part of everything. And we have to learn to live in harmony with all other species, because if we don't, we simply will not survive. We're not a very successful species. We haven't been around that long. We're the last surviving hominid of the primates. We're the last surviving hominids. You know, Neanderthals died out 40,000 years ago. And we're not going to be around that much longer unless we learn to live in harmony with all other species. I mean, this one group of plants, the phytoplankton, provides 70% of the air we breathe, and we've caused a diminishment in phytoplankton population since 1950 by about 40%. But yet the average person not only doesn't know that, the average person doesn't care about it. It's not part of their life, because their entire existence is an illusion. Their beliefs in these, what I call collective mass psychosis, their political, religious beliefs or whatever. Almost every single religion other outside indigenous cultures puts human beings as the center of everything. It was all created for us. We're the most dominant, most supreme, whatever. In my mind, we're just a bunch of overly conceited naked apes who are divine legends in our own mind. But, you know, we don't see that because we're just so full of ourselves that, that we just live in this dream world, and who knows where that's going to go. But I think that we're seeing the consequences that are happening more and more. COVID-19, this particular pandemic, I've been predicting that for 20 years, that there would be more. In fact, there's two sources for existing or for emerging pathogens. One is melting permafrost, which is releasing pathogens that have been dormant for 30, 40,000 years. The other one is zoonotic transmission of viruses, which are being caused by diminishment of ecosystems and diminishment of species. Viruses are a very important part of our, you know, ability to be alive. There are literally hundreds of millions of viruses, and almost every particular plant and animal has a group of viruses associated exclusively with that plant and animal. And those viruses tend to be beneficial for the most part. But when the problem is when you diminish an ecosystem or a species, now that virus associated with that species has to go somewhere. And that's called zoonotic transmission. It's going to jump to another species. Now, over our history, we've had a number of zoonotic transmissions, which weren't all that, you know, bad. I mean, they're uncomfortable. Like, we got the common cold, which is a coronavirus. We got that from the horse. We got flu from birds and from pigs. And we got MERS and that from camels. And there's other that kind of transmissions. But it's going to get more and more serious because there's more and more viruses are going to need a place to go. I mean, yeah. Ebola came from monkeys that jumped to people because it's very closely related. And so my prediction is on this, just from an ecological point of view, that over the next 100 years, there's going to be increasingly more viruses, and they're going to be more lethal. And we have to find a way of living with that, because we're not going to, it's this illusion that, for instance, we're going to develop a vaccine. No, we're not. And I'll tell you why, because it's a coronavirus, and we've never developed a vaccine for a coronavirus. Otherwise, we'd have a vaccine for the common cold. And of all the coronaviruses, there's no vaccines. So I don't see this developing. And what I'm seeing is coronaviruses are very quick to mutate and to evolve. And even if you did have a vaccine, it would last, 6 months before you're on to something else, just like flu vaccine will last forever. So I think the solution overall is we've got to learn to live in harmony with these other species. We have to encourage the welfare and well-being of other species, plants and animals. We have to learn to live with them and not to use them. And that will only be the only solution that I can see.
Listening to you, it becomes very, very evident that obviously we need a change in our awareness, in our mindset, and as you said, in our whole approach of how we live in this world and how we live in harmony with other species. And you said that a lot of people simply don't know about it. And I think it's a difference between not knowing about it and not caring about it. I think there's a lot of people out there who don't know about certain things, but they do really care, but they just don't know what to do. So is there anything that you can share, like looking at your three basic laws of ecology, like what actions do you derive from these laws? Like, what can the people listening, or in general, what can we do, and how can we learn to live in harmony with other species?
Well, there's only one thing you can do is use your abilities, your skills, and that in the best way you can. In 1973, I was a medic for the American Indian Movement during the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota, and that's where I learned a very valuable lesson. We were surrounded by 3,000 federal troops. They were shooting at us, 20,000 rounds a night. They killed two people, wounded 46. And I went to Russell Means, who is the American Indian Movement leader there, and I said, Russell, we don't have any hope of winning this. We're completely surrounded, and the odds against us are overwhelming. So what are we doing here? And the answer that he gave to me stayed with me all my life, and that is, well, we're not concerned about the odds against us. We're not concerned about winning or losing. We're here because it's the right place to be, the right time to do it, and the right thing to do. He said, concentrate on the present, and that will define the future. Don't live in the future, live in the present. That's what I've done with Sea Shepherd all my life. I've never ever gave much thought to whether Sea Shepherd's going to become this big organization or that or whatever. I concentrated on doing the issues in the present, and those actions took care of themselves, and it just evolved into something that I'm even not in control of anymore, and thankfully. And that's the way things develop. That's how movements develop. Also, you're never going to get 100% of anybody's support. Every social movement in history was carried out with less than 10% of the population. Every single one. Anti-slavery, women's rights, whatever. And it was always carried out against the wishes of dominant governments. Governments cause problems. They don't really solve problems. Women didn't get the right to vote because the government gave it to them. They got the right to vote because they got beaten up and jailed and ridiculed, not only by men, but also by other women. Slavery didn't end because of governments. Abraham Lincoln didn't end slavery. It was the efforts of Wilberforce and Douglas and people like that, individuals of passion, John Brown and others. Politicians tend to take credit for it, like Woodrow Wilson signed the bill giving women the right to vote. And they saw Woodrow Wilson gave us the right to vote. He was their primary opposition for 10 years. He was totally opposed to it, but he was government. And when it passed, he had to sign it, but he doesn't deserve the credit. Neither does Abraham Lincoln deserve the credit for the emancipation of slavery. I mean, the guy was actually was very anti-black, really, and a bit of a racist. So, we glorify these political leaders when they don't do very much at all.
Paul, when I listen to you, I ask myself, when you look into the future of our species, or when you look into the future, what gives you hope? What gives you optimism?
Two things. One thing I told you is that, you do what you do in the present and let the future define it. But two, I look at the history of extinctions on this planet. There's been five major mass extinction events. We're now in what I call the sixth extinction, or the Anthropocene, because we'll be responsible for it as one species. Mm-hmm. But looking back at those five major extinction events, what did they all have in common? I mean, the Permian extinction drove 97% of everything into extinction. There was only a 3% survival of species. And yet here we are, because it takes about 18 to 20 million years for a full recovery from a mass extinction event. So what gives me optimism is that I know that 20 million years from now, this is going to be a beautiful planet. We probably won't be here, but we can't destroy the planet. So to me, the conservation environmental movement is about saving humanity from itself. Not about saving the planet. That's a little arrogant to say we can save the planet. Not only just saving ourselves, but all those other species that they'll take down with us. But the planet will survive, and the future will be what the future will be. So if we want to be part of that future, then we have to get involved. I'm not sure that humanity as a whole is capable of doing that, because we're suffering from this disease, which is anthropocentrism, or which I also call collective mass psychosis. We can't see outside of the restrictions that anthropocentrism places on us. Therefore, our values are so out of sync with nature. For instance, imagine going into the city of Mecca and spitting on the black stone. Chances of getting out of that city alive are going to be pretty remote. You'll be ripped to pieces. Nobody will have much sympathy for you. Go into Jerusalem and spit on the Wailing Wall, or take a pickaxe and start hacking away. You're going to get an Israeli soldier's bullet in the back, and nobody's going to have any sympathy for you. Or go into Rome and destroyed the one of the like the Pieta, and see how people react to that. Again, no sympathy, because those things are sacred. We will rise up violently to protect them. But you know, the greatest cathedrals in the world, the rainforests of Amazonia, the temperate forests of California, the Great Barrier Reef of Australia, these are incredible cathedrals in nature. And every day we go in and we desecrate these cathedrals with bulldozers and logging operations and mining operations. And how do we react? Oh, a few protest signs here and there. We write some letters to some politicians, put on animal costumes and jump up and down with picket signs. But if the rainforest, the Great Barrier Reef, were as sacred to us as an old wall in Jerusalem, a stone in Mecca, or a hunk of marble in Rome, we would violently rise up to defend it. But we don't do that. And that's the clearest evidence that I know of just how out of sync we are with everything.
Yeah.
Back a few years ago, a ranger in Zimbabwe shot and killed a poacher who was about to kill a black rhinoceros. And human rights groups attacked him and said, "How dare you take a human life to protect an animal?" And I think his answer to that really encapsulates the situation we're in. He said, "You know, if I was a police officer in Harare and a man ran out of Barclays Bank with a bag of money and I shot him in the head and killed him right there on the street, you call me a hero and pin a medal on me. So how is it that a bag of paper has more value than the future heritage of this country?" That is the hypocrisy and the contradictions that define anthropocentrism.
Where do you think we took the wrong turn there? I mean, everyone is aware. I would think that if we destroy the rainforest, our chances of survival or our future will be pretty bleak. But we still don't act in accordance with that awareness.
Yeah, we're not that intelligent, really. It's, you know, one of the things that we developed over the years, served us well in 20,000 years ago, was this ability to adapt to diminishment. As resources became diminished, we adapted to it. And that was a good thing then, but now it's not a good thing. We adapt to diminishment now and we just accept things as they change for the worse. In 1965, the very idea that you'd be buying water in plastic bottles and paying more for that water than the equivalent amount of petrol would have been absurd. Nobody would do that. And yet here we are, we've adapted to it. We accept it, that's what it is. Fish species are disappearing. We forget that they were there. Animals, species have disappeared. You know, there used to be gray whales in the Atlantic. There was a giant auk, like a penguin in the north, in Iceland and in Newfoundland. You know, there was Carolina parakeet, the passenger pigeon, the eastern bison. There was the European lion, the European elephant, all of these creatures. And not only did we wipe them out, but we've now actually forgotten they were ever there. You know, how did a lion get onto the shields of Europeans? Where did that come from? Because there used to be lions in the southern part of Europe. There used to be tigers up until 1973 in Turkey. We just wiped them out, and then we forget that they were ever there. And you can only do that for so long until things begin to fall apart. All of those species are interdependent with each other. You can't kill off seals because you want to, we're going to kill the seals because they're eating all the fish. You have to look at what kind of fish are they eating. They're eating fish which are predators to other fish. Harp seals are major predators to mackerel and oolakins and herring, which prey upon cod. So when you lower harp seal populations, you increase the predatory fish populations, causing a decline in codfish. And we don't look at things that way. We you know, there was once 45 million harp seals in the North Atlantic. They're now not less than 10%, and they keep saying, they're overpopulated. But when the Europeans first came to the New World, there was no shortage of codfish. It wasn't the 45 million seals that were eating them. It's human greed that was doing it. But again, we justify everything that we do if it benefits us. And where did this all begin? I think it all began with the development of agriculture. When that became the development of patriarchy, it became the development of hierarchy, all stemmed out of agricultural communities. We left the garden of the natural world to become dependent upon the fruits of our own creation, really. And we felt pretty superior to everything ever since.
Do you think there's any way of turning that back, of changing the mindset again, of changing those structures again? Or do you see that being like our future being determined, like a lot of people, for example, that I meet who are in the technology field, who develop new technologies, they are very much in this thinking that our future is determined by our growth mindset, that we always want to have more, that we always need to develop new things and need to innovate all the time.
Well, you know, the people of my generation, since World War II until now, we have enjoyed probably the greatest era in human history of material wealth and freedom. We're not going to see that again because of diminished resources. Resources simply are not there. Fossil fuels are finite. And people say, we have enough to last for 100 years. Yes, 100 years. What is 100 years? What are you going to do after that when the population is 12, 15 billion? You know, a world without fossil fuels cannot support 12 to 15 billion people, can't even support 7 billion or even 3 billion. You know, so at some point, we're going to either have to voluntarily find a way to reduce our, not just population, but our consumption, or the laws of nature will kick in, the laws of ecology will kick in, and we'll be forced to do it with ecological collapse, and it'll be like a dystopian future. I look on the world I see in 2120, I think will look more like 1820, back to horses and windmills and sailing ships, because the materials aren't there. And after you collapse fossil fuels, then what do you got? You know, people say, well, what about nuclear power? Well, you know, that's just, they don't even think it through. To get 1 ounce of uranium requires 1,000 tons of pitch blend ore, and it takes an incredible amount of fossil fuels to mine, crush, refine, and transport that ore to get that. And they don't put that into the equation. It's a very highly intensive use of fossil fuels, nuclear power is, but they just say, well, they just look at, here, we'll put some uranium into the thing, and it's going to power this and make all this steam, and we're going to have power. But they don't look at where did that uranium come from and what happened to get it there. So there, you know, and again, with windmills, what are you going to do? There's only so many windmills you can make, then you run out of, you got to have the materials, some metal, you got to refine the metal. You can't do that with wind power. So we keep coming up with this. They say, oh, well, we're going to use wood chips. Oh, we'll burn down our forests in order to do biomass. I mean, everything has a price. And it really all comes down to there's too many of us consuming too many resources. And unless that changes, then there is no there's no resolution to the problem.
How does your own lifestyle look like with all these realizations and all the things that you've experienced firsthand? Do you like what kind of foods do you consume? How do you travel? What do you do with your family? Like what consequences have you taken after realizing all these things that you just shared?
Well, first of all, not much travel going on now.
Yeah.
All of our ships since 1979, all of our ships were vegetarian. Since 1999, all of our ships are vegan. You don't have to be vegan to join the ships, but you have to be vegan while you're on the ship. So because a vegan lifestyle is probably the best way to address things like climate change, because the slaughter of 65 billion animals every year and the incredible taking of fishes from the ocean, that is a major cause of groundwater pollution, major cause of dead zones in the ocean, and the major contributor to greenhouse gases. So if we're serious about addressing that, we have to go in that direction. When I was a director of the Sierra Club in the United States from 2003, 2006, they did not want to hear that at all. Any talk about changing diet was, that was just to be dismissed right away. They just didn't want to hear about solutions. And the reason for that is that a lot of these groups, I call them feel good organizations. They're there to people to join so they can feel good. Like, hey, I'm part of this solution because I'm a member of Greenpeace, or I'm a part of the solution because I'm a member of the Sierra Club. And then they all can go sleep at night without worrying about it. I drive a car, trying to get an electric car, but even then you're still a part of the problem. And that's really one of the problems, because we're put onto a treadmill from the time of our birth so that we're all hypocrites. We have to just accept the fact that we're hypocrites and try to mitigate where we can, try to lower our carbon footprint where and how we can, but you're not going to be able to erase it completely unless you're living in a cave as a hermit somewhere, and that's not going to change anything for anybody. So right now I live in the in a forest area, and within nature, I mean, we've got bears and we've got foxes and we've got turkeys, something like that, which is nice. And I don't certainly don't live in the city, and a vegan lifestyle, and you know, and a low consumption lifestyle, which is very important.
I want to talk to you about our relationship with the ocean, because it fascinates me that most people love the water, and we love the incredible dimensions of it, and watching the sunset over the ocean and the power it all has. Yet, as you said, we destroy it at the same time. And I would like to hear a few things from you that you've witnessed over your career that have shocked you the most, so that we can create an awareness of what's going on, so that maybe we can all learn to reflect our own behavior more.
I was raised in an Eastern Canadian fishing village, and I have seen a consistent diminishment of species and habitats since then. The village I lived in was the largest, probably the largest lobster fishing village in the world, really, St. Andrews by the Sea. You know, I remember lobster traps that were lined up for a mile, you know, piled on top of each other down the road before they could be set. So I go there today. If I go to my hometown, there are no lobster traps. There's no fishing boats because there's just no fish left in that area. So what we're doing right now is investing more and more money into heavy gear technology to extract less and less fish. So these heavy commercial fishing vessels, you know, these are investments of a couple hundred million dollars each. Now, when you have that kind of an investment, you owe the banks a lot of money. That means you got to get a lot more fish in order to pay for that. And so it's a vicious circle. We got to catch more fish so we can make more money so we can pay off the banks. And the end result is we're going to wipe out the fisheries. According to Dr. Boris Worm and Dr. Daniel Pauly, the two foremost fisheries biologists in the world today, by 2048, there's not going to be any fishing industry because there won't be any fish. And one solution to that is we can learn from indigenous cultures like the Polynesians. You know, for hundreds of years, a shaman in a Polynesian culture would declare an area kapu. This bay is kapu. No fishing for 20 years. Anybody caught fishing? Death penalty. And everybody says, oh, that's a little severe, you know, putting the death penalty for fishing. But not from their point of view, because they knew that if the fish disappeared, they would die. They couldn't live. And therefore, it was a matter of survival and life or death. And that's why it was so, the punishment was so severe. There are no kapu areas anywhere in the world today. There's no place for the fish to hide. Where do the poachers go? National parks and marine reserves. They take 300,000 sharks a year illegally out of the Galapagos Marine Park. And that's true of almost every sanctuary. You put a designation of marine sanctuary on the map, and you can guarantee that the poachers will head there to see what they can get. Poaching is out of control. 40% of all of the fishing vessels out there are operating illegally, probably more. And there's millions, there's literally 4 million fishing vessels out there. So it's, you know, it's just, the numbers are just absolutely, I'm actually quite surprised that the fish have even survived. But again, it's adaptation to diminishment. Back in the 90s, there was a fish out of New Zealand waters called the orange ruppy. You could buy it everywhere. It was in Trader Vic's and all these different places. You don't see it there anymore. It just disappeared. Because an orange ruppy takes 45 years to become sexually mature. It can be lived to 200 years. But its rate of procreation is so low that it couldn't keep up with the demand. And so rather than stop the fishery, they just fished it out and moved on to another species. And so we're seeing species after species just disappearing because there's always something else. You know, somebody once joked, oh, we'll get down to, all we'll have left to eat is jellyfish. And then I went to this one thing, an event one time, and they were serving bloody well jellyfish salad. So even got down to eating jellyfish now. Basically, we have to leave. You know, at the 2015 climate change conference in Paris, I gave a presentation. Of course, it was rejected completely. But I said we need at least a 50-year moratorium on heavy gear commercial fishing. Shut it all down to give the ocean the opportunity to repair the damage that we've done to it. And of course, that's not going to happen. But that is the only solution. We have to shut it all down and allow the ocean to repair that damage. The two periods in the 20th century where the ocean recovered in a very short time, World War I, World War II. When people were busy killing each other, they weren't taking the fish. And actually, fish populations increased during those two particular periods. We just have to give it time and it repair itself.
I wish we could find a way, like, how to accomplish that. I mean, it was so evident now that during COVID-19, all the things, like how nature could breathe again. And it's so obvious. Anyway, you say that if the oceans die, then we all die. When would you, like, when is the ocean dead? Like when would you declare the ocean to be dead? Or you gave the plankton example, but could you elaborate that point a bit more?
If anything should impact the phytoplankton in the world's ocean, that's it. That's game over.
Okay.
Nothing lives on this planet without phytoplankton. That's, we have the air to breathe. I mean, the forests of the world, which we're cutting down, only provide 20-30%. The rest comes from the sea. So, you know, imagine a world without bees. You know, the problems that's going to cause with pollination and crops and things like this. A world without worms. You know, a few years ago, I was taken to task by the Fox Network in the U.S. because they called me up and said, did you say that whales and, did you say that fish and trees and worms and bees were more important than people? I said, yeah, I said that. So how could you say something so outrageous? Well, I said it because it's true. They can live here without us, but we can't live here without them. We need them. They don't need us. In fact, the world would be better off without us. But we need them. And we have to understand that if we lose them, we basically were committing suicide. And but it's very difficult in an anthropocentric mindset to get around this idea that it's all about us. You know, we even created our own God in our image. Every religion's done that. I mean, I reject right off any religion that says that God is a primate, a monkey, whatever. And, you know, it's love, it's infinity. The finite mind has no concept of infinity, can't even imagine it. And so when people say, well, you know, how did you think the universe was created if there's no God? I said, well, it's always been here. It's infinity. Well, somebody had to create it. And I said, well, who created it? And they said, well, God. I said, well, where did God come from? Well, God's always been there. I said, see, there you go. You grasp. It is so delusional. When I was teaching at UCLA, it's so delusional that I had to, at one point, I actually got in trouble for this because somebody said, well, the concept of doublethink, which is believing in two completely opposing ideas at the same time. And they asked me for an example. So I said, how many people in here are Christian? And 6 or 7 of them put up their hands. I said, how many gods you believe in? Well, there's only one God. Oh, really? Who's Satan? What do you mean, who's Satan? It's all powerful, so powerful God can't deal with him. He's immortal. That is a very definition of a God. You got all these angels, all immortals, all powerful. You guys got more gods than the Hindus, and yet you say there's only one God. So you're believing in two opposing ideas at the same time. And of course, then they come out and say, well, God created the angels. I said, yes, just like Zeus created the other gods.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
There's one question that I often like to ask people, and that is if they could choose between exploring space or the depth of the ocean, what they would choose. And I don't think I need to ask you that question, but I'd be curious to understand from you, like, why our oceans are still such a big mystery. And maybe maybe you could speculate a bit, what do you think we could still discover in the oceans? I mean, it's such a fascinating place.
First of all, I have no problem with exploring space, because if you can spend money on exploring space, you might be able to spend less money on military issues. I think that the ocean presents a lot of difficulties, mainly pressure, but there is exploration of the ocean. There's exploration of space. They're both going on. I mean, people like Sylvia Earle has been involved with this for years and years. So oceanography and everything is a real science and has really discovered a lot. And we know a lot about the depths of the oceans, but we also don't know a lot about space, for example.
Yeah.
So it's really a question. I see nothing wrong with humans exploring space or exploring the ocean. There's nothing wrong with that at all. It's an understanding. Actually, though, here's the one thing that human beings are useful for. If we're ever about, and we have, because we have technology, if this planet is ever going to face another thing that we did 65 million years ago with an asteroid coming towards us, we're the only species that could actually do something about it if we put our heads together. Yeah. So we could predict, but that's about the only useful thing I can think that we can do.
There's one final thing that I would like to talk to you about, and that is your thinking about being immune against the criticism in order to do the kind of work that you do, which you mentioned in a couple of videos. And could you explain that point a bit more? Why? Or I would like to understand from you if you see a moral challenge when you are enthused and passionate about something and immune against criticism, because it could be a dangerous recipe for destruction as well. How do you differentiate between doing something that you where you feel you're immune against criticism and doing the right thing?
The strategy that I developed called aggressive nonviolence means that we're aggressive but nonviolent. In 42 years, we've never injured anybody. I don't see what we could be criticized for. We've never caused an injury to anybody, never sustained any injuries to anybody. We operate within the boundaries of the law, and we operate within the boundaries of practicality. Somebody wants to call me an eco-terrorist. I said, well, yeah, I never worked for Monsanto. What the hell does that mean anyway? what is an eco-terrorist? It's somebody who terrorizes the planet. That's Union Carbine, that's Monsanto, that's Exxon. That's not us. The environmental conservation movement is probably the best example of nonviolent opposition in the history of the planet. And so I certainly am not concerned about that. You know, after we sank Iceland's, half of Iceland's whaling fleet destroyed their whale processing plant. We shut them down for 17 years. I had a former colleague from Greenpeace say, what you did in Iceland was unforgivable, unacceptable, an embarrassment to Greenpeace, an embarrassment to the movement. I said, well, you know, didn't sink those ships for you or Greenpeace or the movement or any person. We sank them for the whales. Find me one whale that disagreed with what we did, and I promise you we won't do it again. Our clients are whales and sharks and turtles and fish and seabirds, not people. So what can anybody say to us that I'm going to take seriously as a criticism? You know, people are so shallow. And, you know, for instance, I'm a conservative. You don't get more conservative than being a conservationist. Radicals are out there destroying the planet. They're the extremists. I'm just trying to preserve the status quo. And that is the very definition of conservatism. You know, I was doing a right-wing talk show in California one time, and I went on there. It was fun. The guy said, look, my conservative, I have more conservative values than you do. Why do you quiz me on your conservative values? And let's just compare them. And he said, okay, what's your position on gays and women in the military? I said, well, I'm totally opposed to gay people and women in the military, and I'm going to tell you why. Because I'm opposed to men in the military. I'm opposed to the goddamn military, you know, so that's why. And I said, why does gay people and women want to be involved in something like that anyway? And they said, well, what's your position on welfare? I said, totally opposed to welfare. All those corporate welfare bums with their hands out begging at the public trough, you know, we're always bailing out these banks and these corporations. They're a bunch of welfare bums. And that was sort of getting to him. Then he said, what's your position on abortion? I said, totally opposed to abortion. All these postnatal abortions, all these unwanted children that nobody wants and nobody gives a shit about until, they do when before they're born. But after they're born, they're on their own, you know. I said, that's why I'm totally opposed to postnatal abortions. And it was something like didn't know how to deal with or anything like that. So you just have to think in a completely different way. And the best way to deal with that is to take on a biocentric perspective. Look at everything from the point of view of everything, really, and not just a point of view of humanity.
I think you shared a lot of very valuable insights, and I must say that I deeply admire your approach on how you see things and what you dedicate your life to. And When are you off to your next mission?
Well, we have missions all the time. Right now we have two ships patrolling West African waters above Barker and the Sam Simon. We're about to launch our seventh year of our campaign to protect the endangered vaquita in the Sea of Cortez, the Vaquita Refuge. We'll be going to Mapello Island off of Colombia to work with the rangers to protect sharks there. We have campaigns coming up in the Caribbean with our vessel, the Jean Paul de Joria, anti-poaching campaigns, working primarily with Dominica. And we'll be doing anti-poaching patrols in the next couple of years in both the Mediterranean and in the Southern Ocean. We're looking to secure a couple of more ships to make that more efficient. Our vessel, Ocean Warrior, which has been quarantined now for 7 months in Singapore, hopefully we'll have it out by September. And I have to hand it to that crew's been on board. They haven't even been allowed to leave since March. And once we get secured, then we'll take that vessel, we'll be going to Peru to work against illegal fishing operations, primarily by the Chinese fishing fleets, which are just out of control in the Eastern Tropical Pacific.
Thank you for this conversation. It was great, and all the best to you. And I hope that we can take this conversation further sometime and maybe do some stuff together. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.